This country is at war with Germany.
Hallo zusammen und damit herzlich willkommen zur vierten Folge Wunder, Wissen, Weltkrieg. Mein Name ist Raffaela Höfner. In jeder Folge spreche ich mit ehemaligen Soldaten, mit US-Veteranen, mit Überlebenden und Opfern des Zweiten Weltkriegs. Hört aus erster Hand die Erlebnisse, die Schrecken und Wunder, die meine Gäste selbst erlebt haben. Hier geht es um den Tatort Zweiter Weltkrieg, ein Podcast gegen das Vergessen und für den Frieden. Dezember 1944. Da vorne sind sie, höre ich über Funk. Wir fliegen dicht nebeneinander, Flügel an Flügel. Ich zuerst, sagt mein Commander und geht nach unten. Die Panzerstellungen der Deutschen sind gut getarnt. Durch die Bäume kann man sie nur schwer erkennen, doch wir wissen beide, dass sie da sind. Wir müssen sie ausschalten. Die Panzer haben schon viel zu viel Schaden angerichtet. Es gibt nur diesen einzigen Versuch. Es muss uns gelingen, bevor sie uns bemerkt haben. Hoffentlich ist keine Flak in Sicht. Ich weiß, wie unsere Maschinen aussehen, wenn sie von deutscher Flak getroffen werden. Dann gibt es kein Entkommen mehr. Ich richte meine volle Konzentration auf das Ziel unter mir. Meine Augen sind scharf wie von einem Luchs. Nur selten entgeht mir was. Der Bombenschacht des anderen Flugzeugs öffnet sich und die Bomben fallen. Ich sehe nur noch schwarze Punkte, die sich immer weiter entfernen. Als sie auf die Panzerstellungen treffen, explodieren sie mit voller Wucht. Dann bin ich an der Reihe. Ich gehe auf 1000 Fuß runter. Rauchschwaden ziehen schwarz nach oben. Auch ich öffne den Schacht und lasse meine Bomben fallen. Ich sehe, wie die umliegenden Bäume zerfetzen. Volltreffer. Dann ziehe ich meine Maschine wieder nach oben und verdrücke mich in die Wolken. Geschafft. Die Mission war erfolgreich. Wo ist der Commander hin? Ich lasse den Tatort hinter mir und lenke meine Thunderbolt zurück zu unserer Base. Sie ist nicht allzu weit entfernt. Motorengeräusche durchbrechen die Stille. Ist das der Commander? Nein, es ist definitiv keine unserer Maschinen. Das hätte ich sofort gehört. Alarmiert blicke ich mich um. Woher kommen die Geräusche? Sind es Deutsche? Da. Eine Messerschmitt 109 zieht aus den Wolken hervor und jagt über den Himmel. Direkt auf mich zu. Ich will zur Seite lenken, vielleicht eine Rolle machen, doch es ist zu spät, um zu reagieren. Schüsse peitschen durch die Luft und eine der Kugeln trifft meine Windschutzscheibe. Öl spritzt mir ins Gesicht, in den Mund, in die Augen, sodass ich ein paar Sekunden nicht sehen kann. Mein Motor fängt an zu stottern, so laut, dass mir das Herz in die Hose rutscht. Ich werde im Sitz durchgerüttelt. Was ist passiert? Ich werfe einen Blick nach hinten. Mein ganzes Flugzeug ist von Kugeln durchlöchert. Wind peitscht ins Innere. Ich muss zurück. Ich muss es zur Base schaffen, komme was wolle. Wieder stockt mein Motor. Zu meinem Entsetzen tauchen hinter mir erneut 2 Messerschmitt auf. Sind sie gekommen, um dem Ganzen ein Ende zu setzen? Ich denke an zu Hause, an meine Kameraden, an den Commander. Später werden sie erfahren, dass ich abgeschossen wurde. Vielleicht finden sie meine Maschine. Ich atme tief durch und bereite mich auf das Ende vor. In der vierten Folge nehme ich euch mit in das Cockpit eines amerikanischen Bomberpiloten. Ed Cottrell wurde am 17. Januar 1922 geboren und wuchs in Pennsylvania auf. Er wird also bald 101 Jahre alt. Nach dem Angriff auf Pearl Harbor meldet er sich freiwillig und wird in Wisconsin zum Piloten ausgebildet. Mit 22 Jahren kommt Ed mit der 48. Fighter Group über England nach Frankreich. Dort wird er als Jagdflieger eingesetzt. Mit seiner P-47 Thunderbolt-Maschine soll er Gleise und Brücken sprengen, sowie Maschinengewehrnester und Panzerstellungen bombardieren. Jeder Einsatz kann ihn das Leben kosten. Einige seiner Kameraden kehren nicht wie er zur Base zurück. Drei große Ereignisse haben sein Leben nachhaltig geprägt. Ich nehme euch jetzt mit in das Gespräch, damit ihr Eds Erzählungen aus erster Hand erfahren könnt. Hin und wieder hört ihr Mike Robertson sprechen. Mike arbeitet im Veterans History Museum in North Carolina und war so freundlich, Ed zu besuchen und ihm bei unserem Zoom-Meeting zu helfen. Das nachfolgende Interview in dieser Folge ist auf Englisch. Welcome to my podcast, Ed. I'm really happy that you joined us today. You were a bomber pilot in World War II and flew over 60 missions in Germany, Belgium, and France. Before you take us with you into your cockpit, could you give me a brief biography of yourself, when and where you were born?
Okay. I was born in 1922, which means I'm 100 years old now.
But you're still a rock star.
And I was born in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. And then my parents moved to Pennsylvania when I was less than a year old. And I grew up in a little town in Pennsylvania called Slippery Rock. And it has a university, which now has 10,000 students. And it's a state university for the state of Pennsylvania. And I went to elementary school, junior high school, and then college. Graduated. The war started in 1941 with Pearl Harbor.
Yes.
And in 1942, fall of 42, I was told by my draft board I was going to be drafted into the military. So if I had any ideas of which branch of service I should volunteer, or else I would be drafted into the Army. So I had already had a pilot's license, so I knew I wanted to go into either the Army or the Navy. Armies, and so the Navy told me if I joined them, I would leave that the next day. The Army said if I joined them, I'd go back to school and they would call me. So I went back to school.
Yeah. What did you study?
I was health and physical education.
Okay.
Slippery Rock's a big health and PE school. Big health and PE school.
Yeah.
And my father was a health and PE instructor, professor. And I graduated in, I was called into the service in February of 43. Then the school, I was to graduate in May of 43, and the school extended me, gave me my degree, so I actually graduated in 1943. I went to Miami Beach for basic training, was sent to a school in Beloit, where we were there for 6 weeks until they were ready for us in California. Then I went to Santa Ana, California, and assigned to Visalia for my primary flying, to Chico, California, to do intermediate or basic training, and then Loop Field, Phoenix, Arizona, for my advanced training, where I graduated as a pilot.
How did the training look like? What did you have to, like, practice or train?
We started with a small plane and then went to a higher horsepower plane, and then in advance we went to the AT-6, which is the advanced trainer for all pilots, and so that's what you flew and then until you got your wings, and then I was assigned to Wendover Field, Utah, to be transitioned into the fighter that I was going to fly in the war, the plane called the P-47, the Thunderbolt, which was a single engine fighter plane, one person. And I spent six weeks at Wendover Field before I was sent to England and then signed to the 48th Fighter Group, 493rd Fighter Squadron, at Cambrai, outside of Paris.
Okay.
And that's where I first met the 48th Fighter Group. and was there for 3 weeks before we went to St. Tron, Belgium. It's called St. Troyden, but we call it St. Tron, which is midway between Liège and Brussels.
Okay, I know Brussels, yeah.
Okay, right. It's 1 hour towards Germany from Brussels.
Yeah.
Which was the closest airfield to Bastogne, which had the Battle of the Bulge.
But you started in England? Where did you stay there?
I was just in England for a week, just long enough to be assigned to a fighter group.
Okay.
In Europe. And so I did not know flying out of England. And then I met my at Cambrai, and then we went to St. Troy, and we were there for 5 months. And during that time, I had three three incidents when I give a talk to kids or adults or anything, I tell them of the three major incidents that I was involved with during my time at St. Tron. And the first one took place on December 7th we were at St. Troyden in December 7th in 1944.
Yeah.
And we were assigned to do a flight. The Germans were on one side of a soccer field and the Americans were on the other side at the little town of Jülich. I don't know if you know where Jülich, Germany is. J-U-L-I-C-H. It's up near north of Aachen, if you know where Aachen
is. Yeah, I know Aachen, yeah.
Okay, well, it's a little town, and we were assigned to go in and try to do skip bombing with the over the soccer field. So, and when the day we were to leave, the weather was socked in. It was like 300-foot ceiling. We still took off. We flew at ground level, came in, dropped the bombs, and made two passes, came back out. We found out we were successful. When I got back from that mission, I had 30-some bullet holes in my plane from ground fire, from rifles and ground fire. So on that mission, our 48th Fighter Group, 493rd Squadron, was given the unit citation for that mission because it was hazardous because of the low ceiling, the fact that we were flying at treetops at 300 and some miles an hour and so forth. The second one was on December 17th, which was the start of the Battle of the Bulge, and we were told that the Germans had tanks in the woods near the city of Koblenz. So we were sent out to see if we could destroy the tanks. We spotted them in the woods, and I was flying wing to our squadron commander, and he went down first and dropped his bombs. I went down and dropped my bombs. As we pulled up, we ran into a group of German ME-109 fighters. And one of the fighters was firing at him, and I called him and told him that there was a 109 at 1 o'clock. And at that time, the German 109 turned and fired at me, and one of his 20 millimeter cannon shells hit my plane and exploded, and oil came all over the windshield, and I was hit, and I told him I didn't know whether I could get out or whether I was going to have to bail out or I would, what was going to happen. So he said, if as long as you can keep flying, head 270. So I started heading 270, and on one of about 5 minutes, and I was just barely keeping airspeed enough to keep flying. When I looked out to my right, and there was a German ME-109, and on the left was another 109, and they crisscrossed behind me, which I thought they were going to shoot and fire and shoot me down. Instead, they crisscrossed and came in and flew more formation and took me back across the bomb line. When we got to the bomb line, and we were just barely staying airspeed. I think we were going like 120 mile an hour and stalling speeds 115. They peeled off and went back to Germany. And then I was able to get directions to get back to my airfield. And I, just as I got ready to land on my airfield, the engine froze over and I had to dead stick it in. But anyway, I was able to survive that. During that mission, I lost one of my roommates. I had six roommates that I lived with, and one of them got shot down and killed that day. And his name was Art Summers. He's from Southern California. And so I was lucky to survive that mission.
Yeah.
And
did you see were the German planes so close that you could see the faces of the pilots?
I could see. Yeah, they were two pilots. They both looked over, and when they got ready to leave, they made circles with their thumb and little first fingers.
Like this.
Just like that, before they peeled away, and they put their thumbs up, and then they went off. And I sure would like to meet those two guys, because I thank them for saving my life.
Yeah.
They could have shot me down with, or forced me down with no problems.
Do you know any reason why they helped you?
I have no idea, except that when people ask me if the positions would have been reversed, would I have attacked it? And I said, no, I would never attack a crippled person that couldn't defend themselves. There's no honor.
Yeah.
And I'm sure those two pilots felt the same way. And since then, I've heard of other incidents where American pilots have helped German planes and German pilots have helped bombers get back. Instead of continuing and trying to force them down.
That's unbelievable. It's really crazy story. So how many people were in your plane? You and the co-pilot and someone else?
No, we didn't have co-pilots. I was the only one in the plane. The 47 is a single engine.
Oh, it's a single engine. Okay.
Yeah, the pilot's the only person in the plane.
Okay.
There's nobody up there.
And how do you drop the bombs? Do you have a special thing that you can use?
Yeah, there's a on the stick that you use to fly the plane. There's a trigger that fires your machine guns.
Yeah.
And then over to the right, there's a place where you pull and you drop your bombs when you're ready to go.
Is there an option that you miss the target? Because I watched lately a movie about a Copenhagen bombing, and they were supposed to hit the Gestapo building, but one pilot, he missed the target, and he was bombing a school, and so all the other pilots who came after thought that it would be the target, and they just bombed the school.
Well, see, they're up at 30,000 feet. We're dropping our bombs at 1,000 feet.
Yeah.
And we're going down at 400 mile an hour. And so you can drop your bombs pretty much on what you're going after, because you're down that low.
So you can see better.
You can see. And that day, that was the start of the bulge. It was very cold, and it was... there was no snow was on the ground, but it wasn't snowing that day. It was a nice flyable day. The next day, the weather turned very bad, and we didn't fly for 6 or 7 days. And that's when the Germans made inroads and got to Bastogne, where you know what took place there, and that's history.
Yes.
And the Battle of the Bulge is a very historic thing. So at the end of about the maybe 28th or 29th of December, we were able to start flying. And on New Year's Day, our fighter group was assigned a mission to fly over Bastogne. And I was not on that mission, but I was assigned to runway alert, which is four airplanes at the end of the runway with their engines going. And if radar spots or picks up any air traffic, they tell us, and then we immediately take off and go to engage them. Well, on that day, we didn't know it at the time, but every airfield along the battle, the bomb line, the Germans hit, and over our airfield at St. Tron, eight FW-190s, Falk Wolf 190s, came in at ground level. And we had two on our airfield, we had two burned out bombers, a B-17 and a B-24, that had landed there after being destroyed or hit while they were on their missions, and they couldn't get back to England, so they landed on our airfield, and they could not be repaired. They were damaged so far. And the FW-190s went right straight for those two bombers that were in the middle of the airfield. And then they shot at them, made a pass. They did not drop their belly tanks, and the anti-aircraft shot down a couple FW-190s. And the other made another pass, and again, they went right for the bomber. They didn't go after the four of us at the end of the runway. And then on the third pass, all the Falk Wolf 190s were shot down except one. And he came in, and he was going down the our runway, and he kept going down, and he crashed right at the end of the runway. And his body was thrown out, and we were in a ditch and went out to the body. And he was a very young German youth. He was probably 16 or 17 years old. And he had a bullet hole in the middle of his forehead where a 50 caliber machine gun had hit him. And all eight planes were destroyed. Couple of the pilots that were hit and crashed survived, and they became prisoners of war from our thing. So on that day, same day, our fighter group was on a mission, and I lost my second roommate on that mission. He was hit by German flak and crashed. So during the Battle of the Bulge, I lost two roommates of my six roommates. And since that time, last year, I was able to go up to Holland, and I was taken to the grave of one of my roommates who was buried in the American cemetery in Holland.
Oh, so which one? Because I've been in May in Maastricht in the U.S. cemetery.
This is in Holland. I don't know where it exactly is. And so I didn't know that when I went there, the fellow that took me to back to Normandy and Belgium and Germany in September last year, he took me to the cemetery, and I didn't realize it till I came across the cross and saw my roommate's name. And then realized that this was his grave. And the man that took me over, his name is Andrew Biggio. He wrote a book called The Rifle,
okay,
which is a best-selling book, a military book in the United States. So if you get a chance to read The Rifle,
The Rifle.
It has the experiences of a lot of military people in World War II. His name is Andrew Biggio. And anyway, Andrew put that picture of me kneeling at the cross, and so far 14 million people have seen that picture. You may have seen it. If you want to go on the internet and pick up Andrew Biggio and his book, The Rifle, you'll see a picture of me kneeling at the cross.
Okay.
Of Ted. So that's is on the internet now. All
is, was there any like a chance to get away from German flak when you're in the air, or was it just like really really hard to
wherever you flew, there was always flak.
Yeah.
And you didn't do anything and just hope that the flak didn't find you.
Yeah.
You just kept flying and it would be exploding all around you. And if it hit you, it did a lot of damage. I was never hit by flak. My biggest problem was almost every mission we flew where we strafed, we got hit by ground fire. So I always, almost every mission we came back, we had bullet holes in our plane from machine guns. If a fighter plane got hit by flak, they were going to go down because there's
no chance to keep the plane up.
It's pretty damaging they do to planes when the flak hits them.
So you could say like every mission was like a suicide mission.
You never knew what you were going to run into. And when you finished, you landed, you were, thank the Lord, you were back. And the only thing is, once the Germans started retreating in February and March, and the German Air Force was pretty much eliminated. There were not many. The biggest problem was flak. And the longer the from March and April and May, we did, our missions became less dangerous than they were prior to that time.
Yeah. Where did you go? In which German cities have you been after the Battle of the Bulge?
I don't remember all the cities. I know that we ended up in Nuremberg.
Yeah.
That was the last place that I was at. And we never went to cities. As we moved forward in Germany, they would put metal strips in the out in the pasture, and we would land on those metal strips, and then we lived in whatever houses we could find that were empty, or we could, garages that were open, and that's how we lived. From week to week, they moved.
Day by day.
How
did you experience the German population at this time?
I didn't run into many Germans because they were on the move.
Yeah.
And they had left their homes. I sort of gathered that most of the Germans that were not in the German army were pretty much not happy with the way the war was going. And they were just trying to survive. That was sort of the impression that we got. As we went moved forward and moved along, and we got into a house, you would find that people fled very quickly, and their house was pretty much in shambles and so forth.
Yeah. I just heard of the German Volkssturm, the like older people or the young guys, the Hitlerjugend, had to fight at the end, so they didn't have enough soldiers of the Wehrmacht, so they used everyone to fight.
Well, most of their pilots were pretty young, and you could tell they were inexperienced. The German pilots before the Battle of the Bulge were really good pilots. They were very experienced, they had been well trained, and they were really if you ran into a 109 or an FW-190, they were good pilots. Once they had on January 1st, when they tried to hit every airfield, their Luftwaffe took a tremendous loss. They lost almost 1,000 airplanes.
Whoa.
Because they tried to hit every airfield and took a tremendous loss. And that was about the end of the Luftwaffe.
How did you notice that they were inexperienced at the end?
Well, when they you could tell they were inexperienced, because if you go in strafing and you have a belly tank, you don't go in with a belly tank, you drop it because it's full of gas.
Yeah.
And very vulnerable. So anybody with experience knows you don't make a bombing run or a strafing run with a belly tank on your plane.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Have you been involved in the Nuremberg bombing? I think it was in late April or something.
I was not involved in that.
Okay.
Although we were there, and that's where the last, and I think May 5th was the last mission, and I flew out of the airfield at Nuremberg on May 5th, right before, and I think May 7th was the end of when the declaration came out.
When did you hear about Hitler's death?
Yeah, we heard about it, but most of us were more interested in getting home than we were about whether Hitler was alive or he wasn't alive. We knew that they knew that the war had been declared, and everybody was, are we going to Japan or are we going home? And so if you had enough missions, you could go home. If you didn't, you were on our fighter group that was on its way to Japan. And that's where they went. And then the war with Japan ended, and they turned around and came back. They never did get to Japan.
Where have you been when the war ended on May 8th? In Nuremberg?
Yeah.
Okay. And how did you experience that?
Well, I was told that I had enough missions that I could go home. So we got ready to, I had to go to Antwerp to wait to catch a ship. So I didn't catch a ship until the end of May the end of May. And then I caught an LST to go back to New York. And the 48th Fighter Group was on a ship to go to Japan, and they left I think maybe the 11th or 12th from Antwerp to catch this ship, but we stayed there until we could catch the one to New York.
So I usually ask what was the biggest miracle, but you already told your miracle that the German pilots...
My miracle was on December 17th.
Yeah, when the German pilots let you pass. That's really crazy. It's one of the biggest miracles I've ever heard of World War II.
Well, there's a book out called Higher Call, tells of a German Luftwaffe pilot that took a B-17 home that was crippled, and instead of shooting at him and trying, he made sure that the B-17 got through, and the enemy aircraft wouldn't shoot at him because he was there protecting him. And there's that book called The Higher Call.
What advice would you give to young people, or what do you tell the classes you visit?
I tell the people that one thing they ought to try to do is respect people. And everybody's different. There are nobody, and you try to be kind to people, respect them, and try to get along. This world has a lot of problems right now.
Yeah.
A lot of problems, and both military and social. And the one thing that I try to, that in the United States, we need to get not fighting each other, but we need to respect each other and work together. Our country has some problems right now, and I know Germany has some problems also.
Yes.
And that's the future is in the youth, and that's why I think the youth need to know what happened 80 years ago.
Yeah.
and how it caused a lot of pride, and that should never happen again.
Yeah. I think the next generations might forget what's happened. So it's so important so that they listen to people like you to tell their story, because when some days, like, you remember the World War First maybe, but all the wars before you, it's already forgotten, just in history books. And it's so important to keep the memories alive.
Well, when I came back, I was in Germany last September and again this last March. I was, first time I was at Dusseldorf.
Yeah.
Second time I was at the Wessel. I had a chance to talk to some youth, and I was very, very impressed with the fact that they were concerned and wanted to know more about the war because they didn't want anything like that to happen again.
Yeah.
When I was there, I was noticed also the older Germans were still not very pleased talking to an American. They still had some bitter resentments, and I don't know whether that's disappeared, but older Germans that suffered a lot were not, I don't know, there wasn't the friendliness that as there was with the youth.
Okay, my experience, the Germans really like the Americans, but they have a bitter taste for the Russians, because the Russian army was way
harder. The Russians were terrible to the Germans. The Americans treated the German people, I know we did.
Yeah.
We never harmed a civilian, but the Russians were terrible.
Yeah, and my other grandfather, he was born 21, and he was a signaler, and he fought in the Battle of Berlin, and he told really bad experience, and he got captured by the Russians and had to go to a camp, and he escaped a few years later with a friend.
He's lucky he escaped.
Yes.
He probably might have lost his life from the Russian, because they were not very kind to the German soldiers. And I know the Americans that captured German soldiers treated them with respect. Well, I'm happy that a nice young lady like you is interested in finding out what went on, and you respect what your grandfathers and great-grand went through. And I know that you're trying to get the students that you're teaching to understand how it is to be respectful. You need to take up golf, because it's a good sport, because you can keep playing it. Even at 100, I still go out and play every once a week. So.
Yeah, that's really good. Mike told me you went par jumping or something like this, or jump off plane.
Yeah, I jumped twice. I jumped when I was 90. The man that took President Bush down was the fellow that took me down. And then when I turned 100, but in order to turn 100, I wanted to jump in remembrance of my two roommates that got killed in World War II, and the same individual. We jumped again last November the 8th.
What?
From 14,000 feet.
You're crazy. We jumped. You're really crazy. I would not jump.
Oh, yes. It's fun. It's real. I'll tell you, when you start free falling, you go pretty fast. When the chute opens, it's the most peaceful. You're up and it's quiet, and you look down and see all the countryside below, and you just float around. And
yeah, this part might be fun. I was paragliding once.
It's really really fun once the chute opens.
Do you plan to go back to Germany or Europe?
I don't know. I've been twice in the last year, and The fellow that took me just told me to hang loose. We're going someplace. I don't know where we're going. He takes veterans to various places. I was in March. I was back at St. Tron, Belgium, and we had we dedicated a plaque at the airfield there for the 48th Fighter Group. Yeah. And then we were at Bastogne. And we celebrated the Battle of the Bulge again, and met with some of the people from that area. So I don't know where I'll go.
Yeah,
I might be back over there. I would imagine if I'm still alive. I don't know.
You go jumping out of an airplane here in Germany then. So yeah. Wait, you live near, which major city is close?
I live two hours from Charlotte. I live a half hour from Asheville, which is not a big city.
Yeah.
But Charlotte's the biggest city, and it's east of us 2 hours. We're right at the foothills of the Blue Ridge, the Appalachian Trail.
Yeah.
The Blue Ridge Mountains.
And you know Dachau concentration camp? It's north
I know, I've been there.
Yeah, yes. I've been, yeah.
It's north of Munich, and with a school class, with the 10th graders, we go every year to visit the concentration camp.
Yeah, that's an experience the kids ought to see, because they see the worst of the war.
Yes.
That is a memory that... that just says there should never be any more wars.
Yeah.
When you see that.
Have you known of the concentration camps while you were in Germany, a soldier or a pilot?
I got a chance to go to Dachau, but that's the only one that I.
Yeah.
And I was able to get back to Bend to Munich, and I forget where else I was, but. And that was my wife and I took a trip over there, and then we took a cruise down the Danube River, a river cruise.
Okay. Have you been to Berchtesgaden, to the Eagle's Nest?
Yes, I've actually went there very quickly. Didn't spend any time. I did spend some time in Austria. A week in Austria, and I wished I'd have been able to spend more time at Berchtesgaden, but I...
It's really beautiful there.
Yeah, it is. Austria is a beautiful country.
Yeah.
We have how soldiers like to bring back souvenirs. We have a piece of fabric from the couch at Berchtesgaden that somebody cut out in our museum.
Oh, okay.
And we have a picture of Hitler meeting with his staff at Berchtesgaden, and you can see the couch. And the pattern on the fabric is the same.
Okay. The Easy Company, I think, made it to Berchtesgaden, right? And they took the cognac or the champagne back to America and had a
sip. Yeah.
One of our veterans, he's passed away now, but he was one of those that helped liberate Berchtesgaden. And he's the only man I met who could say, I went to the basement where there are barrels of beer and I drank Hitler's beer.
Yeah.
So, is there anything else that you want to know or I can tell you?
Yeah, maybe if you could describe the war in like a few words, which words would you pick?
If I could describe the war, all I can say is that war's not fun.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any really happy experiences that come out of war. I mean, survival is the most important thing, and there are all phases of survival, and some have it easy, some have it very difficult, but war is not good.
Yeah,
not good at all.
Yeah, and never good. So
no.
It's the same when you
better
watch.
It is better to love than to hate.
Yeah, definitely.
Definitely.
When you turn on the news now, you see so many bad pictures and videos out of Ukraine and
Russia.
Yeah.
Yeah. The media right now is absolutely focused on the negative and not very much on the positive.
Yeah.
Unfortunately. Okay, well, I hope that this has been interesting for you, and that you would be interested in this. When I was in Normandy in a year ago, September, this September, we were at a book signing, Andrew's book signing, and the last 10 minutes of the hour, they allowed high school students to come in to talk to the veterans.
Oh, cool.
And one of the girls, I didn't know, she was with a group, and I didn't meet her. I don't remember. But anyway, when I got back, she sent me a letter and wanted to know if she corresponded with me, would I answer questions about World War II? And so she just graduated from high school, and she's out of Normandy. And so about once a month, I get a letter, and she speaks English just like you do.
Yeah.
And she writes very English very well. And she, every letter I get, she has 4 or 5 questions. And so I answer them and send them back. So we're pen pals.
That's really
so
cool.
Maybe I'll have another pen pal.
Yeah, you have to.
Well, it's great talking to you. And do you have any other questions, or then let you go and you can go on, get your golf club and get out and hit the balls.
Sounds good. So if I got any more questions, I can just go back at you and send you a Zoom or an email. Well, thank you so much for your time, Ed. We really appreciate it. Thank you. History, Wissen. Die Jagdflugzeuge der Deutschen und der Amerikaner. Die P-47 Thunderbolt, jene Maschine, die auch Ed Cottrell geflogen hat, war ein einsitziges Kampfflugzeug und das schwerste einmotorige Jagdflugzeug des Zweiten Weltkriegs. Mit über 15.000 Maschinen war es das meistgebaute US-Jagdflugzeug in dieser Zeit. Die P-47 war in Höhen von über 8.000 Metern sehr schnell und das Flugzeug hatte eine enorme Rollleistung. Die Messerschmitt 109 war ebenfalls ein einmotoriges, einsitziges Jagdflugzeug vom deutschen Flugzeughersteller Bayerische Flugzeugwerke AG. Mit rund 33.000 Maschinen ist die Messerschmitt 109 das meistgebaute Jagdflugzeug der Geschichte. Der Erstflug fand bereits im Mai 1935 statt. Bis zur bedingungslosen Kapitulation der Wehrmacht 45 blieb die Messerschmitt 109 das Standardjagdflugzeug der Luftwaffe. Ab Mai 1935 war der Oberbefehlshaber der Luftwaffe Hermann Göring. Ed Cottrell ist mit seinen 100 Jahren nach wie vor ein begeisterter Golfspieler. Sport gehört schon immer zu seiner Leidenschaft. So hat er zu seinem 100. Geburtstag einen Fallschirmsprung gemacht, den er seiner verstorbenen Frau und seinen gefallenen Kameraden gewidmet hat. Er ist gesundheitlich in sehr guter Verfassung und befindet sich gerade in Belgien. Immer wieder kehrt Ed an den Ort zurück, an dem er als junger Soldat gekämpft hat. Beim letzten Besuch durfte er sogar mit einer historischen Maschine mitfliegen. Der Flug führte ihn über Bastogne, wo er am Ende des Zweiten Weltkriegs in der Ardennenoffensive im Winter 44-45 gegen die deutschen Besatzer gekämpft hat. Eds Geschichte zeigt vor allem, dass persönliche Entscheidungen, die man trifft, das Leben anderer beeinflussen können. Die deutschen Piloten hätten ihn damals ohne große Mühen abschießen können. Nichts stand ihnen im Weg. Es hätte im Himmel nicht einmal Zeugen gegeben. Stattdessen haben sich dazu entschieden, ihn zu verschonen und ihn sogar ein Stück begleitet. Nach dem Krieg konnte Ed eine Familie gründen und bekam 2 Töchter. Er blieb der Army noch viele Jahre treu und arbeitete später als Sportlehrer und professioneller Golftrainer. Zu gerne hätte er sich bei den deutschen Piloten bedankt. Er kannte zwar nie ihre Identität, kann sich aber noch genau an ihre Gesichter erinnern. Zu seinem 105. Geburtstag plant Ed erneut einen Fallschirmsprung. Ich bin sehr dankbar, dass ich Ed Cottrell kennengelernt habe und er mir seine Geschichte erzählt hat. Der Krieg hat auf allen Seiten große Opfer gefordert. Ed ist ein sehr positiver und optimistischer Mensch, der der bis ins hohe Alter aktiv ist und sich immer noch für Frieden und Freiheit einsetzt. Wenn auch du dir seine Erzählung angehört hast, bist doch du einer dieser Zeitzeugen, die dazu beitragen, dass die Vergangenheit nicht in Vergessenheit gerät. Falls du jemanden kennst, der seine Geschichte gerne mit mir teilen möchte, damit diese viele Zuhörerinnen und Zuhörer bekommt, dann schreib mir sehr gerne eine Nachricht. Meine E-Mail-Adresse sowie den Link zu meinem Facebook- oder Instagram-Account findest du in den Shownotes. Ich würde mich freuen, wenn du das nächste Mal auch wieder dabei bist, wenn es heißt Wunder, Wissen, Weltkrieg.